From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
And good morning. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 85. Well, we'll get there. We're waiting for Phil Conlon. We're going to talk today about the demonstration, the breaking of it yesterday, I guess it was. And a kind of unfortunate story. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about what happened on the bridge in Baltimore. And also, we're coming close to the anniversary of the what is called the Rwanda genocide. That's me arriving late. Let's begin. I want to tell to get into the story of an unfortunate gentleman in Ohio. He's an engineer, works at Goodyear, a man of good standing, large family. Devout Catholic. His name is Eric Shimini. Always, as long as I've been doing this, I still wrestle with the names sometimes. Shimini, Eric Shimini. And his family has made a statement. He's been arrested in Ohio, charged with giving a false account of his immigration so far. That seems to be the principal matter, but it has to do more deeply with what happened in 1994. And one of the things we point out on the show is that every year at this time, someone gets accused in a Western capital, and it becomes the story, and it becomes part of the great manhunt that every year they have to say, oh, there's the criminals are still out there, but our countries are helping hunt them down. And they often arrest people around this time, and they often have a court case going. And in the case of one in Boston, which we will say a little more about, they either brought the conviction or the closing of the case on April the 6th. To make a perfect coincidence of information so as to stir the political pot, to reinforce the current government of Rwanda. And, of course, it's been the government of Rwanda since April the 6th, basically, 1994. And it is closely aligned with Britain, the United States, France, and it's their favorite spot. And it's the doorway to Eastern Congo, where they have been removing minerals ever since. Western companies have made a fortune with the natural resources of the Congo through the back door of Rwanda under the leadership of Paul Kagame. And at any rate, I'm going to read the statement. We'll make some further discussion of it. This is a family statement of Eric Shimini regarding the baseless accusations and assassination of his character. The United Nations International Tribunal for Rwanda was established in Arusha, Tanzania, to account for all principal orchestrators of the 1994 genocide in Rwanda. And Eric Shimini's name never appeared. It never appeared. The Human Rights Watch drafted intensive investigative reports at the time as to those responsible. Eric's name never appeared. The local Gacaca courts, a system of transitional justice in Rwanda, following the genocide, the Gacaca courts founded a system of transitional justice in Rwanda, following the genocide were established. And for decades after the genocide, Eric's name went unassailed. Only after he agreed to act as a defense witness did these false accusations arise. And those familiar with the Rwandan judicial system know exactly why. If you dare question the official Rwandan narrative, you become a target, and it's sad the U.S. federal government, federal prosecutors, are doing Rwanda's bidding using U.S. taxpayers' money. Our family vehemently denies all allegations brought against Eric and asserts his complete innocence. He is a beloved, active figure in the community, a devoted husband and father, and a man of deep faith, as evident in every aspect of his life. We attest to his moral integrity and dismiss the charges against him as incompatible with his character and beliefs, as those who know him would agree. We express our heartfelt gratitude for the overwhelming support that Eric has received from friends and the community at large. Together, we will see this through, and Eric will emerge victorious. His good name will be cleared and his integrity restored. That's the signed the Eric Shimizu family. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Phil Conlon. Let me just check my notes. Yes, I'm Phil Taylor. This is Phil Conlon. How are you doing?
Yes, good morning, Phil.
We're having one of those days.
We are.
Yes. So far, so good. Now, I've read this statement by this gentleman, his family, and I have to say, I have worked at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Worked there for Charles Roach, David Jacobs, Defend Dixon, Ramsey Clark, in a number of cases. One of the cases that Charles I worked on was Charles Roach was the lead counsel, and the case began. There was four individuals charged, and three of them were people of political background. But there was a fourth, and that individual had been the head of the hospital in Butare, Rwanda. And so we heard some evidence about this area, and this is where the alleged criminal activity of this individual, Eric Shimizu, allegedly happened. Here you had a United Nations tribunal who were charged to investigate all acts of crimes against humanity and genocide in Rwanda for the year 1994. The hospital is located in southern Rwanda on the border with Burundi. It's called Butare. And Butare had a hospital where this guy was the director. That was very thoroughly investigated. They identified those people who had been pointed out as perpetrators by some people. And as the family says, Eric Shimizu's name never came up. And I don't know why it would. He was a student of medicine, and he has always had the same identity. There's been one of the dirty little games that people say, he's also known as. Well, people with names that are not familiar to our culture and politics, I shouldn't say politics, but our culture, very often change, shorten their names and arrange so that their neighbors can more easily say what their name is. But this is the media has not been helpful because they immediately go on to begin to try to sort of outline a case. There isn't any case, in my opinion, of against this individual. All that happened, from looking at it from experience and background and following the media on these matters, all that happened was that he proved to be an honest individual and a courageous one, because a friend of his, also a medical student from Butare, was charged some years back. I think the year was 2017. And he testified on behalf of the individual. So the people wanting to get at Eric have really created a conundrum for themselves, because had Eric been a perpetrator, it wouldn't be the wisest thing to go into a courtroom and stand in evidence on behalf of someone that you know. If someone came to you and, you know, they're doing criminal activity, whatnot, you'd say, I don't want any part of this. But Eric did that. He, on behalf of his friend, he testified to what he knew. I have to say, in the case of the other individual whose name I don't have at the moment, but I don't think there was a case against him either. Because here we are, this is 2024, and the events were 1994, and in all this time, none of these, as the family point out, none of the organizations that made it their business to try to make a forensic record ever mentioned Eric Shimiyi, nor his friend, by the way, that was convicted in Boston. And so this is something that, tragically, we have to talk about. Every anniversary of the events of 1994, this kind of thing, this matter comes up. And we have zealous prosecutors. We have the government of Rwanda that wants to continually stir things so as to, and accuse people so as to justify their holding on to power in Rwanda, because they now advertise themselves as the people who saved the country, you know, from a genocide, when in fact all that happened was it was a 3-month war that they won. And so they accused the losing side of crimes. And now, and every year they have to produce a criminal to say, well, there's another one, you know. I hope that there will be the prosecutors and others will take thought and not further persecute this individual, but it's very unlikely. My guess is it's going to be an ugly time, tough time. I think the Catholic Church should do more, because the Catholic Church was accused by this government, Kagame's government, of complicity. There was never any proof of that. It's part of the fairy tale of what happened in Rwanda in 1994. We're saddled in Canada by having had a general named Allaire who was present, and because he's called a general, people think he had troops. He didn't have any troops, no Canadian troops, so no one was under his direct command. And the event that triggered it was the assassination of the president of Rwanda, Habyarimana, as well as the head of the army. And so the government was decapitated in one blow. The plane was shot down. The International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda never investigated the plane. Well, they did. I got to back up. They actually did investigate. And the lead prosecutor, who we interviewed on the Taylor Report, said that they found evidence that the RPF, Paul Kagame, had shot down the plane. And so the investigation was shot down. Louise Arbour, celebrated Canadian whatever judge, told them, and she's never denied it, your investigation is over. Bring all your paper, bring everything you've got to my office. And she said, and when he brought the brought all the material, she said, "Is this everything?" And he said, "Yes." And she said, "All right, your services on this point are no longer required." And so the investigation of the shooting down of the plane was shot down. And going back to our general, the night of the April 6th and 7th, 10 Belgians under his authority got into a complicated mess, which we won't go into detail about today, and they ended up dead. And as a result, the Belgian government took away the prime soldiers who might have been able to implement the peace, because it was at that time it was no declared war. All that had happened was there had been an assassination of the president of Rwanda. By the way, also aboard that plane was the president of Burundi. If you're interested in these things, they're both Hutu. The two Hutu presidents were murdered in one blow, which, according to the investigators for the United Nations, the blow was struck by the RPF. So everybody in Rwanda, everybody in Africa who knew anything about it, was not surprised, because that fit the modus operandi of the Paul Kagame and his little show. So my point, though, about General Dallaire is that he lost 10 Belgians in a matter of about 12 hours. They were gone through stupidity and a bunch of other things we won't go into today. But they were on a mission they shouldn't have been on, and they ended up killed. And the Belgian government decided to pull their troops. And they were the prime troops. These are NATO troops. They had the most hardware, and what the general, I watched him, I was in court when he said it. See, NATO has lift. They can bring in troops and they can fly them out. I mean, most states, including Canada, actually don't have any lift. They say, "Well, we're going to send a warship to the Mediterranean." They say, "Well, and when will it arrive?" "Well, maybe 2 weeks." They're not going to be there in a hurry. But the Americans, for example, the ships are there, the planes are there, the bombs are there, they're all ready to go. So we had a general that keeps, and because he's called a general, people assume he had a lot of troops, but he didn't have anything. He had then a motley collection of forces who, frankly, were overmatched in terms of the crisis. So as a result, the RPF was free to seize power. And just another detail, because we're talking about the role of Dallaire. The RPF said that if the United Nations tried to intervene, and the story about Dallaire is that he tried to get more people to come, which is eyewash, in my opinion. If they did come, the RPF said they would fight them. That's rarely mentioned. The RPF said they would never allow them in. They're rather like Israel right now. You can't have UN people. They said so. It was them. So the conundrum that you can worry about or think about is, why do we support this collection of characters? And we support them because, as I said earlier, the United States primarily, but also its other Western allies, took over the country in terms of the economy. And they were able to extract coltan. By the way, if you were in the investing business, the coltan became, which we use in to have our mobile phones, that's found in Eastern Congo. So the Rwandans helped the Americans and others go get that coltan, and they still got it. as well as other minerals. So this is a long way around to saying Eric Shimiyi is innocent. His problem comes from the fact that he's a decent individual who, when a friend was in trouble, he helped him. So he's the Good Samaritan. It's just after Easter, we can find a Good Samaritan. Eric was a Good Samaritan, and he's being punished because he gave evidence. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. And as I mentioned, Phil Conlon is with us. Well, let's try out we're going to talk about peace, et cetera. So let's have a little bit of John Lennon, and then we'll come back.
One, two, three, four.
Right. Give peace a chance. We're going to talk about the anti-war movement that was yesterday. Things move so fast. It was yesterday, right? Did the demonstration happen, or was it Saturday?
Saturday.
It was Saturday.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, no, yesterday was Easter.
Yeah.
So naturally, I'm confused. So I'm perturbed about this issue because you could see it coming. Anybody read the editorials? The Globe and Mail, the Toronto Star, National Post, and other varmints began to write over the past month, somebody's got to do something about these demonstrations. They're full of extremist language, and they disrupt traffic, and we're inconvenienced, and where are the police? And you could see it was about to happen. So Saturday was horses. There's no need for those damned horses. You know, that was not a violent demonstration. These demonstrations have been really smartly organized. And by the way, the techniques of the demonstrators have been laudable. The idea of having a truck for a sound system to make, you know, people like the feel of that. That's good. Going to go up the road, you have somebody to speak to people, which is all, as far as we're supposed to know, this is how democracy works. They're never aggressive, these demonstrations. They're very focused. That's another thing that always gets lost. Hey, our media wants to see a fight. And when I say media, the people who run the whole place want to see a fight because that's how they rule. One against the other. It's always got to be antagonistic, and they're the big neutral in separating the bad people. And in fact, they misrepresent what the demonstrations are about. The demonstrations are fairly mild when you consider that the International Court of Justice has heard evidence overwhelming from lawyers from nations saying crimes against humanity are taking place in Gaza, and indeed genocide is taking place. That's the accusation. The court found, yes, there's something to this. It's a prima facie case. So here you go with that kind of background, these demonstrators are calling for an end to the bombing, the freeing the hostages, and incidentally, saying it the correct way, there are hostages on either side. Thousands have been made hostage by the Israeli authorities on the West Bank since this began in October last year. So you have a practical basis to solve it in terms of hostages. Just trade them. They say, oh, no, those are really bad people. Well, I'm sorry. That is the accusation of either side toward the other. Yes, they each regard the other guys, I don't want, as they're the bad ones. But it doesn't really matter. The way to save the situation is by trading. And that's as old as history. But that, of course, hasn't happened. And demonstrators are calling for ceasefire and humanitarian aid to reach the population of Gaza, not by photo op airdrops by a bunch of klutzes who come and go like, you know, moths, but there's a road, and trucks are lined up. They could drive one end of Gaza to the other and look after the civilians. So that is, but in the media here says, pro-Palestinians, pro-Israel, and let's have a fight. I mean, that's really the way they want to pose it. They don't say, let's have justice. Let's feed the people who are starving. Let's provide medicine. They don't say that. They have to, it's pro-Palestine. They're pro-food. They're pro-medicine. And they are very well organized, and their demonstrations, as I said before, are laudable. But the editorialists have decided, okay, it's time now to rough them up. And so they went for the truck, is my understanding, Phil.
Yes, and the police used a rather, the cops, if they decide they want to do something, they're going to make something up. So all of a sudden, they've discovered that they were very shocked and appalled that people were riding on the backs of these flatbed trucks. Well, I can tell you, I've been to a lot of events in Toronto, starting with Labor Day, where hundreds of people are riding on trucks, because that's the way you do it. You rent a truck, you put your supporters on it and stuff like that, yeah, and they're up there with signs, and they go from one end to the other, and the police stand there and smile at you. Same with the Santa Claus parade. All of a sudden, the police were so concerned that they brought the horses in, kettled people. This is the first kettling in Toronto since the 2010 G7 demonstrations, which were, of course, the police rightfully came under heavy criticism for how they behaved that day. So they're doing it again. And they say, well, you know, the police arrested so many people. Yeah, they arrested them under the Highway Traffic Act. I mean, what kind of nonsense is this? You know, this is just a police provocation. And also, it's where they chose to do it. The march had left the downtown, the center, or Yonge Street, and was in an area which is heavily populated by poor people and indigenous people. And that's where the police made their move. And that was a message. And I want to have a shout out to my member of provincial parliament, Kristen Wong Tam, because she nailed the cops for their behavior in very diplomatic language. I mean, she's a very well-spoken and measured individual. But she says that this was the police response was depriving people of their rights. You know?
Yes.
Yes.
And you know what it is, and you put your finger on it, is discretionary power.
Yeah.
You know, it's if you they can do it by saying, well, we're going to ticket. Oh, we're going to ticket them. That guy's car is not parked in quite the right place. Or I asked him to move on, and he didn't move as quickly as I wanted, so I hit him. It is a clear attempt to turn a political question, a humanitarian question, into a criminal, you know, criminalize people. And there are certain powerful people who are delighted with this, and they've been wanting it. And the problem with this is you reap what you sow, but they don't really mind. You destroy people's lives. You cost them. They lose jobs. They get into you go through and frisk everybody, and you find the guy hasn't paid a ticket. And they say, well, you know, we're just enforcing. Yeah, I got it. And so this is where, frankly, the mayor cops out and all the others. is they'd all start looking around saying, oh, it's not my job. Well, it is actually. You have to apply a tone. And we're headed down the wrong road with this latest thing. There is a publication, The Grind, which has been writing about this, and I find their information very helpful. You can find them on Twitter, or is it X, called The Grind TO. And they actually had began reporting on it last night, or yesterday rather, and are updating their reports, and it's very helpful. But we should remind people on this thing of, you know, well, you know, the police are only doing what they have to do because, you know, they're there to blah, blah. Well, last summer, we kept track of an event, an annual event organized by the Eritrean community, which has been going on for decades. They're at Earl's Court Park, and they have sports, and they have song and dance, and they have food, and they have like 3 or 4 days, and it's a happy event, and politicians turn up to have their picture taken. But this time, elements who've never been properly identified came with sticks and identifying shirts, it's a gang. Fine. Now I'm using the word gang, but it's an organized political group that looks like a gang. And they assaulted that Earl's Court meeting, not meeting, but a social event. And a man had his skull cracked. The booths that they always have, some of them were set fire to. They were knocked down. And the mayor and everybody else said, oh, we can't have this. So they canceled the event. And the most remarkable thing that had happened was, of course, the violence, which was observed by the police. There were police there. And so people said, well, this is terrible. You know, no one was arrested. And I said, a man had his skull cracked. No one was arrested. And then there was a similar demonstration took place in Calgary. Violence, people harmed, injured, at what is an annual peaceful gathering of the Eritrean community. No one was arrested. And then in London, England, they had it. And then they had it in Germany, they had it, and Sweden. All violent assaults by guys wearing the same shirt. With sticks, no one arrested. So, you know, it's time to become paranoid, you know. That isn't an accident. That's politics. Because the federal government, the U.S. government, have decided they're going to start being heavy with Eritrea. And so the first thing you have to do is beat up on any Eritrean that doesn't agree. As I mentioned before, those demonstrations had been going on before the current Eritrean government came into being, the one that they don't like. So this is politicization of police work, frankly, seems to me. I mean, and they, by the way, go back and read. I know it's ancient history because that was 7 months ago, whatever. That's it makes it quite ancient. But the police at the time said that this was serious and they're going to investigate and they're going to get on top of it, you know, and you could expect charges, and there never were any charges. There was at the main hotel downtown, there was a second demonstration and similar attacks happened. With the exact same outcome. So that's what I mean. Politics, you can't say, police are involved in politics. It's just, not that they make them up. And Phil, we alluded to it. There's another thing they like to do, which is to see if they can get the police union arguing with the demonstrators. police union can have its opinion. I don't care what the opinion is. But this is ultimately in the hands of our political leaders, and they're responsible. The police do what the police do. But it's a diversion to argue with them, because they immediately go into the union mode. We stand up for our members, we do whatever. And I would say, actually, you could help a lot by not saying a damn thing. Just, you know, carry, do the job, and point to the boss. Say, they told me. You didn't decide, by the way. That was not a discretionary decision of the ordinary officer. That was a top-level decision. Now there are going to be horses. Somebody on the phone said, I want horses. Somebody on the phone said, I don't want that damn truck there. Somebody said that. And that damn truck then was removed. And you do it in a provocative way. You didn't start at the demonstration and say, fellas, we're sorry about this, but you can march, but you can't have the truck. What they did was, you have the truck, then we're going to come in there and get it, right? Come on. I mean, this is, somebody said on the phone, "Get, I want that truck, and I want horses." And then we got it. And it wasn't a cop that did that. It was a big shot. So, at any rate, this is the Taylor Report. Please check out the Grind for the reporting. I think the Grind TO, you'll find up-to-date stuff, and others are commenting on it as well. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM.
That's called the Grind Magazine, and it's thegrindmag.ca.
Yeah. Have you been following them? They're a bright light that's come on the scene, in my opinion. Somebody will tell me it's been there for 20 years, but it's new.
They're new to me, so that's interesting. But they have
interesting material.
Yeah,
these are good. You know what's happened is with all the cutbacks in media, a lot of people trained in journalism, there's no work, so we're getting a lot of that talent now, and that's good. I hope they never go back. But you know, in the newsrooms, they're cutting back. You know, if I want to know what's in a Toronto Star, I read the New York Times, because they just take it, you know, paste it. Or Associated Press, they take it, paste it. And so, yeah, I think we're gaining on the journalism front. Phil, you and I have both taken an interest in the Baltimore Bridge.
And
you were going to look into, I'll just tell you what I found out. And we started asking this, anybody with any thinking about it, construction workers, I'm going to call them that, they were working on pavement, were on that bridge, and five of them died. No, four of them are dead, I guess. They're still looking for bodies, but the first question I had was, are those guys in a union? Because, you know, unions are supposed to be concerned about safety and all that. It turns out, no, they're not. That company is a contracting company. They don't have, there's no union for them, for their people. And curiously enough, as will happen when you have a non-union place, is that they bring in workers who are immigrant workers. One thing I don't know is their wages. I'll bet it ain't a lot. And they are from El Salvador, Honduras, and Mexico.
And Guatemala, I think.
And Guatemala. Yeah.
Poor countries.
Yes.
Where people leave because they need to work.
Dangerous work, and they're not organized. Yeah. And anybody will tell you, where you have a union shop, you have fewer accidents. Number one reason, you can say no. If you don't have a union and you say no, they say, you're gone. That's, you know, I got 10 guys waiting for this job, so you don't want to do that, you're gone. So, you know, it's just a simple fact. So there is a discussion of this going on. There's other factors. I'll tell you my mystery question, and Phil, maybe you know the answer. One of those workers survived a 182-foot fall into to the water. He swam to shore. he's basically, they say, okay. But they haven't produced him. He hasn't been interviewed. I haven't even seen a picture of him. I don't understand how that could be. I swear, if he was a white guy, I have to put it that way, English speaking, I guess they'd be talking about the movie. 182 feet to the water, when the water was so cold that if you didn't get out of it in 30 minutes, you were going to die. Just think about that. You think you could hit the... Nobody's even said, was he in a... You know, the others were in a vehicle. I don't know if he was in a vehicle. They were taking a break, and they were sitting in their trucks. But nobody said, this is what he did. This is how he survived. No picture with arrows showing he'd hit here in the water.
That's very interesting, and that's true. And all we say, well, two survivors were found, the rest are presumed dead, and that's all they tell you. It's like, it must have been a horrific experience for those men. It's so hard to imagine. It's so hard to grasp. And then you see the authorities talking about, this is really bad for the economy. This is bad for world trade, you know. Yes. I have to add, it's also bad for U.S. armaments exporters, because it turns out a lot of U.S. weapons go out through that port. So they're really concerned about that as well.
The Israelis are going to be phoning.
Yeah.
Hey, where's that boat?
But the human beings who were on that bridge, I mean, that's... That's really awful, you know. And it's amazing. Evidently, they were able to stop traffic from going onto the bridge at the
last
moment.
That's because they had cops handling traffic because they were working on it, which meant that there was only, I guess, one or two lanes, maybe one lane. And so they got the sound, and so they immediately just put up their hand. So they did save. I saw a woman interviewed, an Uber driver. And she was the last. She was about to go onto that bridge, and the guy put his hand up, and that took care of that.
So if there was no construction work going on, there might have been many more dead.
Absolutely. The Bronner Builders is a non-union company, and they do contract work.
Non-union is the American
way. And they save
now.
Money for you. Yeah. You see, they're a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
And everybody, we know Doug Ford, who's practically a saint now. He's saved money. Don't worry. The unions just slow things down. They say stuff like, "Is that safe?" I mean, you start talking about safety. You know, you're going to slow everything down. So, there's an individual who's been writing about this. You find it in Salon magazine. His name is Bob Hennelly. You can find him on X at Stuck Nation. He says we're stuck. S-T-U-C-K Nation, Stuck Nation, and his name is Bob Hennelly. He wrote a very good account. Now, as for the rest of why this happened, by the way, I think these people are organized. Tugboats. There were no tugboats. The tugboats only got this enormous thing, the 3 football fields long, 3 football fields, got it out of the to harbor. It had to make a turn and then to go under the bridge. By the way, the bridge was built in the 70s. The size of these barges, or not barges, ships, is now 3 times what they were when they built that bridge. Incidentally, when they did build a bridge, they were talking about building a tunnel. But they said, no, the tunnel will cost too much. So save money, cost lives. So tugboats accompanied it to leaving the dock. I don't know how far they took it. Maybe to that first turn toward the bridge when it immediately lost power. But the tugs had gone back. Again, pointed out the tugboat union people said that the tugboat should accompany the ship until it's out of the harbor, past the bridge and into the ocean, where it can have all the motor trouble that you want, engine trouble. So they didn't they didn't do that because, again, cost saving. You just push it out there, get it on, you know, and then turn back.
So I have a technical question about this engine losing power. Is there no independent emergency braking system on a ship?
It's called an anchor.
Yeah. Oh, that's so old-fashioned. They were using those in the Middle Ages.
Yes. The only thing that works is they dropped the anchor, but it was too late. The weight of the ship, all it has to do is move, and anything in its way is going to move with it. But you're quite right. That is an additional point, is that there's only 22 guys on that three-football field long.
22.
22 guys, and
two football teams.
The Maritime Union people, and I'm just characterizing the name of their union. I know Maritime is in the name. They said that if you had a proper crew, yes, manually they could have stopped it, but 22 is not enough people. There's too many jobs that have to be done quickly to manually bring the ship to a halt. They said, or get it under control. The main thing is they lost control of it. So, again, we're back to cost saving. that's why your potato chips don't cost as much, which is actually they're three times what they used to be. But there were 45 parts of the material, those containers, 45 containers had dangerous chemicals, toxic chemicals.
See, that's another thing. There was a time when you wouldn't mix ordinary cargo with the dangerous stuff, and you would demark the dangerous stuff, and you say, watch out, that ship's got dangerous stuff. Because we have a history of this in Canada, right? We had the Halifax Harbor in 1917. That was blew up half the city, you know.
Yes. Somebody thought it was good. We all know now that the Lusitania did have weapons, you know. The cause of U.S. involvement in the war, Lusitania was carrying weapons and travelers, you know, and they thought, well, we'll use the traveler, you know, as a screen. They won't fire on that. They did because they had been saying you can't have passengers and weapons, but they did it. Yeah. By the way, the people who have power are often very reckless and unconcerned about us. they make calculations, you know, it's like generals, you know, you have to bleed your troops. You ever heard the expression?
Oh, yes.
You want to get a good army, you have to bleed them, you know, to throw them in there and get people used to it, because the first actually human reaction to being shot at is to run. And so if you bleed them enough, they know not to run. They probably still should run, but they stay and fight, and then you have a shot. So there's, unfortunately, reasoning of that type goes on in circles that none of us attend. When people ask, you know, they talk about, well, you know, why did Biden do this? Why did Obama do the other thing? I think the first answer you want to give is, I wasn't at the meeting. If you were at the meeting, okay, then you know. But all the rest of it is just speculation. And that's why we should read people's memoirs and whatnot. You remember the guy from the Trump administration, the one with the mustache is such a fool.
Oh, Bolton.
Bolton.
That guy. Yeah.
He said that Trump said to him, oh, you arrested the daughter of the head of Huawei. He says, that was nervy, you know. And then they both laughed that Bolton had done that. And he said, Trump compared it to somebody arresting his daughter. He said, like for the name of Meng Wanzhou, he used his daughter's name and said, oh, you arrested the, you know, what's her name? Knowing that Canada was about to be eviscerated by be completely out of business on a front where they thought they were developing. And nobody told the Canadians they're going to do that. They told them after, and then told them how to react. When we said we're bleeding, they said, so bleed. That's your job. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT. Again, I'll just tell you, that guy's name is Bob Henley, we should follow this. Please, everybody, let's find out what happened to the... What is the name of the man who fell 182 feet? Why isn't he... You know, you're a New Yorker, Phil, by origin. A man once jumped off a bridge to show off for his friends and survived. I think it was the Brooklyn Bridge. And he became an overnight superhero.
Yes, that's true.
Can you remember his name?
I don't remember his name, but I know this, that when the Brooklyn Bridge was built and you could walk onto it because it had pedestrian walkways, which it does to this day, at the point you were at the, I guess you'd call it the apex of the bridge, you could look down to the water. People said this was the tallest construction above water in the world at the time that it was built. And of course, it was this miraculous thing. Of course, the engineers were kind of conscientious people, and they built it to last, and it has lasted. But yes, and then growing up in New York, my next door neighbor, whose son was my playmate, was a tugboat captain. So I learned a lot about tugboats. They were very, very important. And New York Harbor was just filled with them when I was a kid. You know, it's like you didn't take your boat anyway. And even little people in pleasure boats were told, get out of here. You know, this is a tricky place. You know, we have two rivers coming into New York Harbor and stuff like that. And we're going to manage traffic here. And if you don't need to be here, don't be here. Right, that was the way it was, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad you raised that because that's another point about these the tugboats is that they had turned back instead of taking the ship through the bridge and putting it in the sea. They had the way they do business in that harbor is to. They just take it in out of the dock, and then they turn back. So they heard the emergency sounds, and they got the call, and they turned around to go and help, but it was too late. So had they been there with the ship, this wouldn't have happened.
That had to be a money decision, because the longer the tugboats stay with the ship, the higher the bill is that goes to the owner
Absolutely.
Of the ship. Yeah, it cuts into his profit margin. So get the tugs out of here. We'll just take it out into the ocean ourselves.
Everything, they say, oh, isn't it wonderful? We only need, from the railroad field, they say, oh, we only need one guy.
One guy.
You have 70-odd cars and 20 of them with toxic.
One guy working that train that destroyed that town in Quebec. One guy, you know.
Yeah.
You know, who was in a hotel resting for a few hours before he took the train further the next day, you know?
Yeah, the train came and got him.
Yeah. So, Phil, let me ask you something. This harbor, is this the same harbor that the British kind of...
Yes, it is.
It is. Okay.
This is... you suspect British intelligence is involved?
Who knows? I mean...
The British
they have
called
sleeper,
the Francis...
sleeper agents, right?
Francis Scott Key Bridge.
Yeah.
And this is where the British sailed in. And this is when you hear, the song, Oh Say Can You See?
Yeah.
Yes, that's exactly where it was. And the British made a run at capturing Baltimore and were beaten off. War of 1812. So again, it is the Taylor Report. There is... a few other matters that we could talk about before we go. On the question of terrorism, we said last week on the show, and I want to remind everybody that the British in World War I declared war on the Ottomans, and they chose at that time. They immediately wrote an outline of what they were going to do, and they said, we will make Palestine a protectorate, and we will create a Jewish homeland. And the people they were in touch with, of course, to do that were the Zionist element, but it was a colonial exercise. From that point on, they had once, particularly after the Ottomans had been driven out, then became a matter of controlling the Arab population, and they used they supplemented the British army with the people who later became the Israelis, and they trained them in fighting and techniques. And we talked about Ord Wingate. He's in the approximately 36 in that period, being particularly ruthless. And I'll remind you, Moshe Dayan said we learned everything from him. Ord Wingate had a system of questioning Palestinians or Arabs, and that was to, he would go to a village where he suspected the bad guys were. In his view, he hated Arabs, Ord Wingate. And according to the Jewish militia people who served under him, the British officer, he would line up the Palestinians and he would shoot two and then ask the others questions. If he didn't like the answers, he'd shoot some more. And he said that wasn't anything casual. That was his doctrine. That was how to do it. So you have the Israelis and the British have been hand in glove, and the Americans have just added a hand to it. And that's where we are now. At any rate, we're very pleased with the demonstrators and their courage, and we know they will stay at it. And we hope that medicine and food will reach the people of Gaza. This is the Taylor Report, and 33-45-78 is coming up. And you'll hear a little bit of Flattened Scruggs first.